From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the genocide in Darfur with two people who have been there reporting on it. We'll hear from Nicholas Kristof and John Prendergast. Kristof is a columnist for the New York Times. He won a Pulitzer Prize this year for his columns, which at personal risk focused attention on the genocide. He's made 6 trips to Darfur. John Prendergast is with the International Crisis Group and has been working on conflict resolution in Africa for about 20 years. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the Spanish version of the national anthem and how it's become a lightning rod in the immigration debate. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I was going to start this interview, which is about the genocide in Darfur, by saying that so far 200,000 people have died. But my two guests, who have been reporting on the situation, say that estimate is probably low, and it's impossible to accurately count the dead. My guests therefore prefer to simply say several hundred thousand people have died so far in the genocide. Nicholas Kristof and John Prendergast are joining us today. Kristof is a columnist for the New York Times. He won a Pulitzer Prize this year for his, quote, graphic, deeply reported columns that at personal risk focused attention on genocide in Darfur and gave voice to the voiceless in other parts of the world, unquote. Kristof made his sixth trip to Darfur in March. John Prendergast is a senior advisor at the International Crisis Group. He's been working on conflict resolution in Africa for over 20 years. He worked in the White House and the State Department in the Clinton administration and has worked for a variety of NGOs and think tanks in Africa and the U.S. Prendergast has made many trips to Sudan, three in the past 2 years. This week, the U.N. Security Council passed a resolution. John, what does this resolution call for?
Well, it speeds up, it attempts to press forward the transition from the existing African Union force, which is about 7,000 troops on the ground now, to a United Nations force, which envisions perhaps 2 to 3 times as many troops on the ground. So it just starts the process, starts the planning process, moving it forward. It urges the government of Sudan to accept an assessment team to come out on the ground in Sudan to look at the needs that a United Nations force would require to undertake its mission effectively. And it is lodged in a Chapter 7 mandate, which is an interesting side debate as to whether or not, at the end of the day, if the Sudan government doesn't accept this force, whether the force will be deployed anyway without the consent of the government, which is highly unlikely. But when a Chapter 7 authorization is used, that option is available. So it ups the ante, it ups the pressure a little bit on the Khartoum regime to accede to the international community's desire to have a more effective force on the ground in Darfur.
Well, UN peacekeeping force would be there to enforce the peace agreement, but what's really the status of the peace agreement now?
Well, the peace agreement, they're still negotiating. You know, this only one of the three factions of the rebel of the various rebel movements has signed this deal. The deal is a very imperfect one. It's got a lot of problems with implementation and in the concessions that were wrung out of the government being very inadequate. So I think that the two remaining factions of the rebels are saying we need a lot more in the way of concessions and guarantees before we're going to sign this thing. So they have till the end of the month to sign it. The mediators don't appear to be interested in reopening the negotiations to actually change anything, but the rebels are saying, the two factions are saying, well, you're going to have to because otherwise we're not going to sign.
Nicholas Kristof, you recently, in one of your columns, called the UN a wimp when it comes to Darfur. What are your thoughts on how effective UN peacekeepers would be if they are, in fact, dispatched there?
Well, there would be problems, I'm sure, but they would be infinitely better than nothing or than the African Union force. And the AU force is poorly equipped. It's hopelessly outgunned by the Janjaweed. But even that tiny force, 7,000 people total and 5,000 with guns, has made a huge difference in the places they go. And if you had a robust UN force with a decent mandate and well-armed and mobile, you know, that would make a difference both on the ground in providing security and in sending a warning to the Sudanese government that it needs to rein in the Janjaweed. But, you know, right now we have this disconnect between the diplomacy, where there is inch-by-inch progress, and the situation on the ground, where things are actually, if anything, getting worse.
Why did you call the UN a wimp?
Because the UN has been very diplomatic in the way it has gone about this. And so we have endless discussions in the Security Council and endless expressions of concern by officials. And yet on the ground, we have a genocide that just gets worse and worse and worse. And the UN hasn't, and UN officials as well, haven't, I think, adequately stepped up to the plate and acknowledged this to be what it is, which is a huge affront to human civilization. When you get a genocide underway and you get kids being grabbed because of the color of their skin and the tribe they belong to and tossed onto bonfires as a result of government policy, then I think it's incumbent on the UN to kind of step out of its ordinary paradigm and show a little more urgency. And that is what, 3 years into this, it has not done.
John Prendergast, what are the odds, do you think, that the government of Sudan will accept UN peacekeepers?
Well, I think that they're fighting tooth and nail in order to maximize the concessions that they'll get down the road. I think eventually they will accede to the deployment of UN force, but they want a few things either in writing or understand in principle before that happens. First, they like the African Union force there because it's an ineffectual force, because although, as Nick said, on the ground where they are deployed, they have made a difference, but generally because of the size of Darfur, that's been too few places and too far between. So they want a force that's going to continue to be ineffective, because they still have an agenda that they're undertaking, which is to destroy any roots of the rebellion, to support the changed demographic dynamic that has occurred as a result of the ethnic cleansing in the context of the genocide. And so they don't want a very effective UN mission, so they're going to fight every aspect of it so that it is a limited mandate and the least number of troops with the least amount of firepower. And I think that you're going to see that. The second thing, which they'll never say publicly, but what they really are aiming at when they oppose the UN so vociferously, is they simply don't want the UN forced to act as a Trojan horse to eventually execute any potential indictments that the International Criminal Court might hand down in the context of its investigation of the crimes against humanity that have been committed principally by or at the orders, at the behest of, and the orders of senior government of Sudan officials. So they don't want a scenario where there's 10 or 20,000 UN forces floating around Sudan and all of a sudden an indictment is issued for the defense minister or the head of intelligence or even the vice president of the country, and then these forces are tasked by the Security Council to capture this guy and bring him to justice. That's the thing they're really afraid of.
So you think they're going to try to negotiate some kind of deal where they're immune from that kind of prosecution?
I don't think they can get the immunity from prosecution. What they probably could get is an understanding that the UN force that's deployed specifically for Darfur and specifically for implementing the peace deal in southern Sudan would not be tasked with any other mandate, such as apprehending suspects for the International Criminal Court.
You know, we invited you both to be here on Fresh Air, and I should mention for anyone tuning in, my guests are John Prendergast, who's with the International Crisis Group, which is a global conflict prevention organization, and Nicholas Kristof, who just won a Pulitzer Prize for his columns in the New York Times, including his columns on the genocide in Darfur. We invited you both here together because you seem to be two of the kind of keenest minds absorbed in communicating what this conflict is about to the public. And I'm wondering if you talk to each other much about it. Are you in touch with each other?
We've been in touch on and off for a couple of years, and I've certainly benefited, you know, tremendously from John's wealth of background, both about Africa as a whole and Sudan in particular, and also just his knowledge of the policy apparatus, which is something that that, you know, I'm rather weaker on.
And on my side, you know, as a guy toiling in obscurity, you know, with a small network of activists and Africanists and advocates who work on these kinds of issues of crimes against humanity and genocide and war crimes, Nick Kristof is sort of a name that, I mean, he's a crusader. He's a journalist who's taken his job to the next level in terms of advocacy on these kinds of issues. So when he turned his attention to the situation unfolding in Darfur, it was like manna from heaven, because the columns that he wrote instantly tripled, quadrupled, quintupled the size of the constituency of people who began to learn about the situation in Darfur and began to care about it. And through his columns, I think it has been the single most effective tool of educating the broader American public about what is going on in Sudan. It's had so many corollary impacts. So many people have gotten involved because they read a Nick Kristof column. It's literally indispensable.
Nick, do you think of your columns as having a goal?
You know, I was wincing a moment ago when John was referring to me as a crusader, because I always, you know, I regard myself as, you know, a journalist. I was flinching at that. And, you know, everybody keeps complimenting me and saying, oh, you're a great crusader. And then, you know, I wince again. It seems strange to me as a journalist to go over and over to the same little place of Darfur. But, you know, fundamentally, one of the things that I can do with a column is to help shine a spotlight on issues. Since I got the column at the end of 2001, I've been essentially kind of disappointed with the persuasive power of columns. It seems to me that we don't often change people's minds on issues that they've already thought about. But on issues that they haven't really thought about, we can help put those issues on the agenda. And in an issue like Darfur, where, you know, you just see these incredible and awful things happening, then by bringing that onto the agenda and shining a spotlight on it, you can indeed, you know, to some degree, get people to care. And so that's why I've been going, you know, back again and again and writing about this, because in the hopes that indeed people will care and that it will make a difference on the ground.
My guests are Nicholas Kristof, a columnist for The New York Times, and John Prendergast, a senior advisor at the International Crisis Group. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the genocide in Darfur with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who's made 6 trips there, and John Prendergast, who's been working on conflict resolution in Africa for 20 years. He's with the International Crisis Group. One of the goals for each of you is to just, like, raise public awareness of what's happening in Darfur. So, slowly recognition has been raised. Has there been any kind of payoff that you can see in terms of changes in policy or funding or you know, public statements by elected officials?
That's a great question, because I've been thinking over the last few months that I'm hard-pressed to remember during the sort of 20 or so years I've been working on these kinds of issues where we've had such a enormous gulf between the solemn rhetoric one invokes with the term genocide and the feeble action that results on the other side of the use of that term in terms of actual American and international response, confrontation of this genocide. And I think only in the last few months have we seen an uptick in the real serious debate about policy options. And I think that comes directly as a result of growing public citizen pressure on their representatives in different parts of the country, and those representatives in Congress then going to President Bush and saying, you're not doing enough. It's just not enough to support indirectly this small African Union deployment of force. It's not enough to say that it's a genocide but then not hold people accountable. It's not enough to sort of support a very small and very feeble effort to make a peace deal between them. So I think a very visible manifestation of how citizen pressure affects policy and is affecting policy now is that rally that occurred a couple of weeks ago in Washington, D.C. on the Mall. You know, there was 40,000-50,000 people, which the numbers certainly are dwarfed by some of the larger rallies that have occurred in that very spot. But it was the people that were on the stage. I mean, there was a collection of religious leaders from all faiths, but people who had, and secular leaders, people who had an influence, who have an influence with this administration. And they sat up and said, well, we better pay attention to this. And you saw within a few days, President Bush dispatched Condoleezza Rice's deputy, Bob Zelik, to Nigeria to negotiate with the Africans a peace deal. And they got at least the beginning of a deal. They got a deal that at least one faction signed. We got to now sustain that. But it was a very direct response to citizen action that the president himself then reacted to.
Well, John, one of the things you point out is that one of the things the Bush administration is up against is that they want Sudan as an ally in the war on terror. So by taking action against the genocide, they risk alienating that same government. What are we getting in terms of intelligence from Sudan, and how is that complicating our actions?
We have a fairly rich counterterrorism relationship with the government of Sudan, given that it was a sponsor and a host for Osama bin Laden for 6 years during the 1990s, given that senior people in the intelligence apparatus in the Sudan government now were very directly linked with al-Qaeda and helped facilitate the training camps and movements of terrorist groups and individuals throughout the 1990s. So they have a lot of information. So when we round up a suspect in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or somewhere else, make a call, or we have our station chief go in to meet with Salah Abdallah Ghosh, who is the head of the security and intelligence in Khartoum, and more often than not, we're going to get a little information about the person that we picked up. So that's a valuable source of information. The big question is the only way to get that information to constructively engage and incentivize the path to greater cooperation and thus diminish our advocacy and our robustness with respect to how we confront the genocide? Or if we pressured this government to give up that information instead of just begging and asking for it, if we pressured the government to give it up, would they do it anyways? And the history of U.S. relations with the Sudan since this regime came to power in a military coup in 89 is that when we do pressure them, especially multilaterally, they do come through. And particularly in the 1990s when Security Council sanctions were imposed on Khartoum for their role in international terrorism, they changed their behavior. There were very direct links between harder pressure and cooperation. So I'm simply saying that it doesn't necessarily have to be the only way that we'll get this information is to dumb down and reduce our advocacy with respect to confronting genocide.
I would just add something there, if I can. I agree that I think that concern about counterterrorism cooperation is one reason why we haven't been more active. But I think there are a couple of others that have also played a role. I think one has been concern that if we lean on Sudan too hard, then they will stop cooperating on the separate North-South peace deal, which the Bush administration rightly regards as one of their important achievements. And I think, frankly, the other is that, you know, it's a long way away. The administration doesn't really know kind of exactly what to do. And on any given day, it's kind of just easier just to look the other way and not, you know, because there is no neat, clean policy option, just to do nothing. And I think that is frankly also why other people have been way too quiet. Bill Clinton has a lot of, he's got a lot of contacts, a lot of international weight, and he could really have been helpful if he had made a big deal of Darfur. And he, I think, has been, way too quiet on this issue as well. I think, you know, part of the reason, you know, all across the board has been that this sense of it's just easier to, you know, if you don't know exactly what to do, then just do nothing at all.
You know, getting back to the danger of alienating the government in Sudan because the government of Sudan, gives us certain counterterrorist information. In bin Laden's latest tape, he accused the U.S. of plotting to send crusader troops to occupy Darfur and steal its oil wealth. And he called on Muslims to go to Sudan and stockpile landmines and other weapons in preparation for a long-term war against UN peacekeepers and other infidels. So what are the odds that if UN peacekeepers go into Darfur, that Sudan will become like another front for the jihad?
I think it would depend to some degree on what country those troops were from. I don't think it's going to unfold as Osama thinks, and it's not going to be another Iraq. And indeed, it's pretty incredible that Osama bin Laden is in effect endorsing a genocide in which Muslims are the victims. But it is perhaps true that if the troops who went in were Americans, were Western Europeans, and that the whole UN force, you know, was perceived as kind of Western Christian force, then I think that among Sudanese Arabs that would be perceived, especially in the aftermath of Iraq, as, you know, Westerners kind of invading the Arab motherland. And I think that is something we should try to avoid. And I think it's one good reason to have a large component of Muslim troops, whether they be Turks or Moroccans or Bangladeshis, in that UN force.
Well, you mentioned that Muslims are victims in the war in Darfur. Are most of the victims Muslims?
Essentially, all of them. The Darfur is essentially all Muslim, and people, you know, think because the war between North and South is more familiar to a lot of people, and there the victims were Christians and animists, and there really was a religious element. So they think Darfur is in part about religion, and it's not. It's about various things, including the Arab-non-Arab distinction, but it's not about religion.
Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for The New York Times. John Prendergast is a senior advisor at the International Crisis Group. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's a track from the CD Ceasefire by the Sudanese rapper Emmanuel Jal.
Shuala nyambol shiman dial chikalujen. Jen me iman kena guan chilu shana ngaguan. Ngualende kola shiang dor gualende. Jen la ya yen shiang bieling ba jo nyambol wo kwer tong. Nyangul elme ke nyambul elme ne shiang ya ke jen. Nyambol shada kui oder ngul elme shiang jen la falen shiang tie kut kut guan.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Washington's Spies, The Story of America's First Spy Ring by Alexander Rose. From Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start June 5th at capella.edu. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about the genocide in Darfur with Nicholas Kristof and John Prendergast. And now that the Spanish version of the national anthem has become so controversial, our linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on various translations of the Star-Spangled Banner. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview about the genocide in Darfur. I have two guests. Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for The New York Times. He won a Pulitzer Prize this year for his columns that focused attention on the genocide and gave voice to the voiceless in other parts of the world. He's made 6 trips to Darfur. John Prendergast has been working on conflict resolution in Africa for over 20 years. He's with the International Crisis Group. Nick Kristof, how do you describe what the genocide is with, and the fighting is really about in Darfur to people who haven't been following it?
I think there are a few kind of cleavages among the people in Darfur, the two sides. The most basic one is Arabs versus non-Arabs. And even that is kind of muddy. I mean, essentially what makes somebody an Arab is that their mother tongue is Arabic. And it's not, nothing more profound than that. But secondarily, in the case of Darfur, the Arabs tend to be nomadic herdsmen, and the non-Arabs tend to be settled farmers. And so you have as well some of that that historic kind of attention between herdsmen and farmers. And there's also a skin color difference, that in general the Arabs are more likely to be somewhat lighter skinned, and the non-Arab African tribes tend to be darker skinned. And so often when the Janjaweed are going around killing people, they're saying things like, you know, blacks have no right to live in this land, you're black so we can kill you, this kind of thing. And so you have those kinds of layers. But it's a tension over land and resources, and you had this insurrection that began, and the government decided that the easiest way to resolve it was to slaughter people living in rural parts of Darfur. I think they made a very practical decision. This wasn't, you know, some kind of ideological, notion. This was just a sort of simple decision. Well, you know, in the South, when we had an insurrection, we sent in surrogate militias and slaughtered people, and it worked to some degree. Let's do the same in Darfur.
Do you think that the government has been manipulating divisions among the people and exploiting them in order to get some other people to slaughter other people?
Oh, absolutely. But I wouldn't also, I mean, that question almost implies that there's much distinction between the government and those doing the killing. And I don't think there is much of a gap there. I mean, the government hired the Janjaweed. It gave them uniforms. It has paid them salaries. It opened up the prisons so that prisoners could be recruited into the Janjaweed. On a trip in November, when I was in Darfur, I was driving back from a massacre site on a army road where there were army checkpoints. I saw some Janjaweed, just like those who had been busy slaughtering people in this village I'd just gone to, and they went right through the checkpoint. Nobody, the soldiers at the checkpoint didn't bother them at all. And, in contrast, when I go to a checkpoint, then, of course, I'm stopped. And, I mean, indeed, at one checkpoint, the authorities try to arrest my interpreter. So the Janjaweed are very much a government creation.
What were the grounds for trying to arrest your interpreter?
That he was helping me.
in effect. Right, I guess that's all you need, huh?
It was incredibly scary because... Yeah. Frankly, with white skin and a blue passport, you feel, I mean, you're scared, but you feel a little bit of protection there, that you hope that some really low-ranking person is going to decide it's, you know, above his pay grade to whether or not to kill a foreigner. But killing a local kid, and my interpreter was a member of the Fur tribe, which is one of the, in the village we just visited, the people who'd been killed had all been Fur, killing him would have been just, they could have done that, tossed him into the bush, and that would have been it. And they dragged him out of the vehicle and told me to drive on, nothing to do with you. And he was petrified. I was petrified. Eventually we sorted it out. And
well, how? I mean, did part of you think I better go and protect myself, or did you just think there's no way I'm going to allow this to happen to my interpreter?
There's no way you can allow this kid. I mean, any English speaker in Darfur has essentially been snapped up by the aid organization, so it was hard to find an interpreter. Finally, I found this kid. He was 19. He was a student, and I felt a real responsibility for him. And it was clear that if I drove on, 5 minutes later, he was going to have a bullet in his head. That was going to be it. And so I tried to be as friendly as I could to these thugs and said, I couldn't go without him. I sent my driver off to buy a bunch of fruit at the nearby market to bring back to give to these guys. And I sat down with them and was, trying to be as friendly as possible. But the bottom line, when they realized the bottom line was not that I was not going to drive off, then they detained me as well, and then called in their commander, and he he arrived, he drove up in his own truck after about half an hour, and then plied him with more fruit and tried to be charming. And, you know, then he eventually let us all go. But it was, you know, it was scary. And to see the Janjaweed go right through these same checkpoints just makes you so frustrated. That it's clear that if the Sudanese government just applied the rules that it uses to constrain foreign journalists, it applied those same rules to the Janjaweed, you know, this genocide would be over in a moment.
What are some of the precautions you have to take when you're going to a place in which there is a genocide underway and you have to go there in order to report on what's going on there? How do you protect your own life when there's a genocide going on around? What are some of the precautions you have to take?
I find that Darfur is a harder place to be safe than some others, because there, you know, there's some basic rules when you go to a nasty place. And one is that you stop at every village and ask people what the situation is like between this village and the next village, or are there going to be any hostile people around? The problem in Darfur is that, you know, these villages have been burned and abandoned. There's often nobody left to ask, and you stick out if you're in a vehicle. And there's nobody for, you know, for zillions of miles around who's going to be friendly. There also is a lot of banditry. I mean, the incentive to kill you isn't just because they don't like foreigners, but also because they can steal your vehicle, steal your satellite phone, this kind of thing. And you know, obviously you only drive in daylight. Whenever you find people, you ask them, you ask locally. You know, on my last trip, I went through this scary depopulated area where there was, you know, nobody around, and my vehicle then got stuck, and I was trying to push it out. It was scary, and finally along come some Janjaweed kids, and they were very friendly and helped me push out my vehicle. And, you know, I was terrified that mom and dad were gonna, or not mom, but anyway, dad and, you know, all his buddies were gonna show up as well, but they didn't, and these Janjaweed kids were the most polite young people you can imagine.
That must have been a very bizarre experience, because these are the kids whose fathers are out theoretically killing people in the genocide, and here are the kids, you know, helping you out and being very polite.
Yeah, but actually, in general, I mean, it's fortunately the Janjaweed and the local Sudanese government officials, I mean, they don't read the New York Times. They don't read my column. And it's, you know, it's actually kind of amazing that if you go up to people and you are friendly to them and you speak a little bit of Arabic and you're respectful and you ask for their point of view, then people, you know, you hope are that their instinct may be, you know, not to shoot you, but to give you an interview. And that's why often the people that you're most scared about aren't, you know, aren't you or another American photographer, but rather it's like your local interpreter, because just the impulse when they see somebody like that is, ah, you know, he's a foor, he's a Zagawa, he's worth nothing, may as well just shoot him.
John, when you're traveling as a representative of the International Crisis Group, which is a conflict prevention group, is there respect for your work among the people in Darfur on either side?
I had the unfortunate experience of being declared an enemy of the state back in 2003, which is the last time I got a visa to actually go legally into Sudan. So since then, every trip I've taken, both in the southern Sudan and in the west, in Darfur, has been across international borders, going into rebel-held zones. So I'm largely traveling in rebel-held areas, which are, I'm going to meet people mostly who have been displaced by the violence and not in formal camps that the government has access to, because they're either areas protected by the rebels or they're areas that the government just hasn't expanded its control over. So there's largely a very sympathetic and very almost desperate outreach from people in these circumstances to anyone who comes along, like Nick or I, to meet with them and to hear their stories and to talk with them about the circumstances that they're in now and what would it be required to actually allow them to go home. And so you find almost universal desire for more. You know, we hear so much, of course, in this day and age about in the context of the Iraq invasion and about how the U.S. is unwelcome in so many places. You wander around Darfur and you might get a different view of America's role in the world, because people there are like, when are the Americans coming? You guys called it a genocide now 2 years ago. When is this intervention force coming to save us, to rescue us, to allow us to go home, to protect us from the horrors that we've been experiencing in the context of this genocide?
My guests are John Prendergast, a senior advisor at the International Crisis Group, and Nicholas Kristof, a columnist for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the genocide in Darfur with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who's made 6 trips there, and John Prendergast, who's been working on conflict resolution in Africa for 20 years. He's with the International Crisis Group. Well, Nick, for your last trip, you had to sneak into Sudan from across the Chad border, and then the president of Sudan told you that if you ever did that again, he would arrest you.
Actually, it wasn't the president of Sudan. It was a Chadian.
Official.
Not a Chadian official. They were. I mean, they have pretty good intelligence. They realized that I'd sneaked over the border, and so he read me the Riot Act and warned me, you know, never to do that again, or that he'd imprison me.
How is that going to affect your future travels?
At this point, frankly, the Chadians have gotten angrier about Sudan and are no longer trying to cultivate any favors with Sudan. So I think that would not bother them these days. But the problem is that the whole, you know, Sudan-Chad border area is getting wilder and wilder, and the rebel groups, the rebel factions, are shooting at each other as well. Banditry is growing. So you have, a real nightmare there in terms of security. And one thing we haven't talked about, but is worth adding, that, you know, we've been focused on Darfur, but Chad is on the brink of collapse because of Sudan's efforts to undermine it, or in part because of Sudan's efforts to undermine it. And even if Darfur works out and the peace agreement holds, which I think is a really long shot, but even if that happens, then you could still have Chad falling apart in the next couple of months. I'd give it maybe a 50-50 chance of collapsing before the end of the year. And if that happens, then you will have just a nightmare. It'll be Darfur, but on a much bigger scale.
Nick, your latest trip to Sudan was along the Sudan-Chad border, so you got a glimpse of some of it you're describing firsthand. And one of the stops that you made was to a town that was certain it was targeted for a village, I guess you'd say, that was certain it was targeted for slaughter. What made them so sure that they were going to be attacked?
The Janjaweed had been approaching from the east and had gone kind of village to village, and had, in every case, there were several hundred Janjaweed, had then surrounded the village and started wiping people out and burning it. And by the time I got to this village of Kaloy, the Janjaweed were in the very next village. They'd attacked, I think, 5 villages the previous day, maybe 3 that morning. And they had supposedly spread word that they were going to go after Kaloy next. The Chadian army had come to defend Kaloy the previous evening, but then had realized how many Janjaweed there were and had then fled. At the moment that I arrived in Kaloy, the police were fleeing. And a lot of people had fled, but, you know, there were a lot of families that had somebody who was old who couldn't go. There were people with gunshot wounds in the hospital who couldn't move. And so people there were just kind of resigned to be raped and slaughtered. And, it was an unbelievable thing to see in the 21st century, to see these people resigned to being slaughtered because of their skin color and tribe.
What was it like for you to be driving around this territory in the middle of an active part of the genocide? You know that the town you're in is probably like the next town to be attacked. So you
just feel incredibly helpless. And you know, you see these people, and you know, we're all kind of nurtured on notions of never again and how awful genocide is and how, you know, we've learned the lessons from the Holocaust and so on. And then you go through these places and, you know, you go through burned villages. And why were they burned? Well, because, you know, the people who were living there belonged to such and such a tribe because they had black skin. And then you go to other villages that one village I got to had just been attacked overnight, and then the next village, while I was talking to some villagers, they heard gunshots from a nearby hill, and they just had spears, and they said, well, I said, what are you going to do? And they said, well, we'll wait here hiding, and then in a few hours when we think the Janjaweed may have left, we'll go there and you know, try to find whatever bodies there are. And, you know, to go through these areas and talk to people like that and talk to, you know, the stories just sort of spill out. You know, one man I talked to, his baby had been grabbed from his wife's arms, and the Janjaweed had checked whether it was a boy or a girl. And because it was a boy, it was a six-month-old, you know, infant, they threw it on the ground and shot it. To just go through these, you know, village after village after village, and try to juxtapose that with the sense of kind of moral order that you get in the textbooks or in history about never again is just so dispiriting and leaves you feeling so helpless.
This is another one of those wars in which rape is a kind of standard part of the war. And Nick Kristof, you've described gang rapes, that's become a kind of standard procedure when Janjaweed find a woman.
This is not rape as a byproduct of chaos or war. This is rape as a government policy to terrorize populations. And it's effective as a government policy, partly because there is such a stigma about it, and also because women are terrified, and so they don't talk about it, and so they manage to terrorize populations, to drive them out, to depopulate these areas without generating the kind of you know, bad publicity and body counts that they do when they just massacre everybody. And you know, so it's been incredibly effective, and it just goes on. And often to add to the terrorization, they not only gang rape these people, but they then mutilate them afterward to mark them as rape victims. And you come across these same people, you know, in vastly different areas of Darfur. And I must say that, you know, when I see government officials in this country or at the UN who don't bother to speak up about Darfur, about what they're seeing, and then I talk to these rape victims who have the incredible courage to describe what has happened to them, to brave that stigma, and to risk arrest by the Sudanese for speaking to a reporter about it. You know, I just wish that we could emulate one little fraction of the courage those women show and speak out as well about that kind of injustice.
Well, I thank you both for talking with us. Nicholas Kristof, John Prendergast, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tara.
Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for The New York Times. John Prendergast is a senior advisor at the International Crisis Group. Coming up, our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the controversy over the Spanish version of the national anthem. This is Fresh Air. the release last month of a Spanish-language version of the Star-Spangled Banner became a lightning rod for both sides of the immigration debate. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg points out that it's not the first time the anthem has been translated into another language. What's really different is the reaction to this version.
On May 8, 1905, the German-American community of New York commemorated the centenary of the death of the poet Friedrich Schiller. 25 brass bands and 6,000 marchers carrying torches and banners paraded up Fifth Avenue, after which more than 1,000 celebrants repaired to a Kommers, or beer party, where they sang the Star-Spangled Banner in German. As best I can tell from the press stories, nobody was offended by that rendition, nor did anybody discern a threat to American unity when the German version was sung at events at Baltimore, Sheboygan, or Indianapolis, or when other immigrants sang the anthem in Italian and Czech. In 1901, a former Spanish consul from Chicago personally presented President McKinley with a Spanish translation for use in the newly acquired dependencies of Puerto Rico and the Philippines. Immigrants were enthusiastic champions of the Star-Spangled Banner at a time when it was still vying with other songs to be named the nation's official anthem. The Germans disliked My Country, 'Tis of Thee, which was the other front-runner because its tune was lifted from God Save the Queen. And Catholic immigrants objected to the bit about the land of the pilgrim's pride, which they saw as an allusion to the country's Protestant roots. The German zest for singing the Star-Spangled Banner in their own language wasn't squelched until the First World War, when patriotic fervor led states to pass laws aimed at restricting the use of German. By 1917, nativist groups like the American Rights Committee were denouncing the performance of the anthem in the language of a nation with whom the U.S. was at war. But even then, people continued to sing the song in other languages. When an Italian version was performed at Carnegie Hall in 1919, the New York Times reported that it brought the audience to its feet. But a lot of modern Americans seemed less appreciative of the tribute when a Spanish-language version of the Star-Spangled Banner called Nuestro Himno was released last month. Some took the translation as a sign that immigrants were refusing to learn English. President Bush said, "I think people who want to be a citizen of this country ought to learn English, and they ought to learn to sing the national anthem in English." The conservative commentator Michelle Malkin asked indignantly, "Who is assimilating whom?" Even some supporters of the immigrant groups saw the song as a declaration of linguistic independence. The Chilean playwright Ariel Dorfman wrote defiantly that the song signaled that America is on its way to becoming a bilingual nation, which will soon be articulating its identity in two languages. What's the Spanish for poppycock? The fact is that the vast majority of Hispanics in America already speak English, and the rest are learning it much faster than the Germans, Italians, or those Norwegian bachelor farmers did a century ago. Back then, after all, the economic incentives for learning English were nowhere near as great as they are now. Most immigrants lived in isolated rural areas or urban ethnic enclaves, and a lot of cities had separate public school systems for immigrants, not like today's transitional bilingual programs, but schools where all the instruction was carried out in German or other languages. According to demographers, the average immigrant family in 1900 took more than three generations to make the complete transition to English dominance. Now it takes just over two. By the third or fourth generation, in fact, most Hispanics are as depressingly monolingual in English as any other American group. But in the meantime, Americans are uneasy with the idea that you can serve two linguistic masters. And the anxiety is amplified by a consumer culture that makes multilingualism much more visible nationally than it used to be, even if foreign language speakers are actually a smaller proportion of the population than they were in Teddy Roosevelt's time. It isn't just all the media flap surrounding the anthem. People feel a swell of indignation when they encounter other languages on billboards or ATMs, or as they're spinning their radio dials. Once you let these immigrants have their way on Burger King menus, how far could it be to ethnic separatism and civil war? Those were the specters that Senator Lamar Alexander evoked when he introduced a Senate resolution earlier this month that affirms that the anthem should be sung only in English. Jerusalem is diverse, he said. The Balkans are diverse. Iraq is diverse. Well, and so's my neighborhood of San Francisco, but we don't have any car bombs going off just yet. I wonder if Alexander would have been reassured by a recent LA Times article by Ann Powers that pointed out that the real anthem of the new immigrant movement isn't Nuestro Himno, or Ricardo Arjona's haunting song Mojado, or Wetback. It's Neil Diamond's gloriously hokey They're Coming to America, which the singer originally wrote as a tribute to his own immigrant grandparents. Latinos picked up on the song 20 years ago, when Cheech Marin used it in his movie Born in East L.A., and it's been played at immigrants' rights rallies from Los Angeles to Kansas City to Milwaukee. Now there's an image that Lou Dobbs could keep people up at nights with. Millions of brown-skinned illegals pouring over our borders, and they're singing Neil Diamond songs.
Everywhere around the world, they come into America. Every time that flag's unfurled, they come into America. Got a dream to take them there.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of a forthcoming book on language and politics called Talking Right. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. WHYY's engineering supervisor is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song from the original cast recording of Guys and Dolls. That show, as well as How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, Can Can, and Silk Stockings, were co-produced by Cy Feuer. He died yesterday at the age of 95.
I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and here's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, can do. This guy says the horse can do. If he says the horse can do, can do, can do.
I pick him Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
But his epitaph, he wins it by a half, according to this here and that telegraph.
For Paul Revere, I'll bite, I hear his foot's all right. Of course, it all depends if it rained last night.
I know it's Valentine, cause on the morning line.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bruce Springsteen's new CD features songs made popular by Pete Seeger. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with Seeger that I recorded in 1984. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.